Let's see. Over to 209. Are you happy with what we did? I know that was torturous.
I'm having a senior moment. $17.
18.
18. Okay. I wasn't trying to cheat you.
Actually, you're having a senior moment. 25.
I told you I was going to make a joke out of that line you said. I'm going to give him a piece of my mind. Somehow, I'm going to work that into a joke.
Oh, you're okay.
The psychiatrist said that. I wonder if it's peace.
Oh.
Okay.
Gary, may I also share, on the way over here, we were singing, we're off to see the wizard, the wonderful wizard of Yun.
Yes. That's for sure. Again, why bother with this sort of thing? Because we're trying to see what happens in the paradigm of one individual, how the unconscious is integrated, and all the steps that we'll go through before it is finally successful. Okay, 209, which is where we left off. This is simply saying now what we already said. By identifying Roar at the end of the last chapter with the first light of Easter morning, the author fitted his experience into the framework of ecclesiastical ideas that were familiar to him, thereby weakening its individual value, but by so doing, he escaped the danger of inflation. Okay, the first text, 209. Doth not wisdom cry aloud in the public places, and prunes put forth her voice in the books of the wise, saying, O ye men, to you I call, and my voice is to the sons of God. To you I call, and my voice is to the sons of understanding. Understand, ye foolish ones, and mark the parable and the interpretation. The words of the wise and the mysterious sayings. For the wise have used diverse manners of speech in making comparison with everything that is upon the earth. And then here comes the key image. And beneath the sphere of the moon, they have multiplied parables in this science. Another image for Sophia's moon. What do sunrise, the moon, and the starlight have in common? Well, the diffuse nature, this subtlety. I thought you might enjoy a moon dream. A dream of a woman who had been through a crisis. I think that's all you need to know, really. She was in her 30s at the time. I'm on a trip and come to land that has been purchased by a group of women and men who want a place of safety, solitude, where they can be in harmony with the earth. This group of women and men are goddess worshippers. When we stop the car, we are at a lake. There are stone carvings of men and women dancing in a circle carved on the floor. It looks like Matisse is Rite of Spring. I don't think that's correct. It's not.
It's Monet.
It's not Matisse, and it's not called the Rite of Spring.
I know what she's talking about.
What's she talking about?
It's one of the Matisse paintings where there's a group dancing in a circle.
Yeah.
They're red figures usually, and they're abstract.
Do you know the name of it? I don't remember the name.
I think it's got several names. I think Rite of Spring is one.
Oh, is it one of its names?
I could be wrong about that.
Okay, anyway, you might get a picture of mine. My guide invites me for a swim. We take off our clothes. Other people are already swimming in the lake. Everyone is naked. As I walk barefooted across the stone carvings, I realize the dancers are all linked together in a circle because they are making love. but it also feels like snakes joined together. I close my eyes and allow my feet to caress these dancers' lovers. Then I jump into the water. I allow myself to go deeper and deeper until my feet touch the silt on the bottom of the lake bed. I let my toes and feet feel the mud. Only then can I rise to the surface. When we get out of the lake, everybody is naked, but I don't feel ashamed or embarrassed. It feels good. Now, there is a phone call waiting about a car accident. That would obviously be her own personal crisis. My guide directs me to an apple orchard. It is night. The moon is waxing, nearly full, but not quite. The car accident is serious, as was her personal crisis. But there are folks here who are healers. They know how to work with the natural healing processes of the body. We walk through the apple orchard in the moonlight. So see, there you've got the idea of the moon and the body and the healing, which is of Sophia. The next dream that night repeats the imagery, and I think will give you another sense of what the Sophia process is like, what this moonlight is like. I am in a cabin in the deep woods. There are several rooms in this cabin. I walk into a large group discussion, about 10 people. Gary is there. The group is talking about dreams, actually sharing dreams with each other. I'm thinking about the above locale when Gary asks me, "Why do you think the goddess is filling your dreams so deeply now?" I say, "I think this is occurring because I am," now here comes the important point, "I am relearning a process of seeing life from the inside out." Sophie is seeing life from the inside. Not what does society want me to be, but who is my inner journey asking me to be from the inside out? That's the moonlight. That's the starlight. That's the dawn. Right now, I am really concentrating on that inner guidance. I think the goddess and her world of ecstasy is here to help me. So that's.
I had that dream.
But you wouldn't want to go through what she was going through to have it.
Maybe not. But.
That's the moon. That's Sophia. Okay. A little, yes, definitely. The other thing that. Well, maybe we'll hold that off. She makes the link between the moonlight, bottom of 209 and top of 210, and the descriptions of the lapis. Now, do you all know what the lapis is? The alchemical, the end product of that process, alchemical process. In other words, that would be the final condition you get to that has been started by this strong emotional experience.
Where do you get this definition of lapis?
Out of my head.
Okay. So you've come to the conclusion that's the final...
Well, the alchemists talk about... The alchemists start with the prima materia, first materia. And they talk about all the stages you go through. And then they come to the end point, and they give the end point several different names. One of those names is the lapis.
Okay.
And now...
So is it the stone? Is it the color? Or...
In the alchemical descriptions, it's about a million things. I generally think of the lapis as like the perfect stone. Another word for the lapis is the lapis philosophorum, the philosopher's stone. And it isn't a precious material, but it has the power of producing precious material. So the idea was they make this philosopher's stone, and then they could put that philosopher's stone next to some other material, and that material would turn into gold.
Yeah, isn't lapis one of those stones that they used a lot in Egyptian jewelry and as a very
but see, the lapis here just means it's the Latin for stone.
Oh, lapis meanstone.
It doesn't mean, it's not like lapis lazuli. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because see, that's what I was picking that color to use in this, because that was the, I was thinking you were talking about that color.
No.
Oh.
But the lapis is very often purple.
Okay.
You got to remember, there are as many different conceptions of this process almost as there are alchemists.
I didn't realize that there was a difference.
Lapis, diamond,
lapidary.
Gold,
lapidary, okay.
Would all be different names for the endpoint. Sometimes that endpoint is a valuable material, gold or silver or diamond. Not silver, gold or diamond. Or sometimes it's this lapis which produces it. Or sometimes there's no reference at all to material things, but that lapis has magical qualities. Like it could heal people, or it can, when the lapis is produced, what the alchemist has inside of themselves is produced outside of themselves. It so has a synchronistic reference.
I was keeping a very narrow look, and it's actually much, much broader.
Yeah, it's pretty broad. Yeah, it's pretty broad. So when she's talking about the lapis here, she's talking about the end point of the alchemical process. And if you interpret that, what that means is that lapis is an image of the psychological state we're trying to achieve through working on this very strong emotional experience that attacks us. So you have to, you know, your mind has to really shift gears to work with this stuff. You have to be able to think in images and realize that those images can be a variety of different images. And also be asking yourself psychologically, what does Jung feel that refers to? So you have to be working on several levels at the same time. It's not easy.
Can I just say something too, though? The kind of thing about what she had, I was part of the seeing the color of the color of the lapis. When we're going through that process, couldn't that be a possibility of a symbol or something for her to look at too in her personal journey?
What's that?
When you get a certain color, or you're just saying that that's what you're relating to, maybe that was also something for her, maybe to it in her own process. I'm just asking.
Sure. In fact, I would encourage you, if you feel like it, to take this whole book that way. You could ask yourself, what is my prima materia? What strong emotion am I working with?
I got blessed by you even saying that, because I've been drawn to the color purple. Just in another aspect or something else.
I've been involved with lapis lazuli. I never quite for many years, because it was even kind of a part of an idea for a story somehow that came to me about this land that was of this substance, and everything was carved out of there, and it was like they were transformed here, and they even had a blue tinge to their skin and their hair kind of thing. But I considered it as a very royal, special kind of stone, and that was just from my study with Egyptian stones and stuff like that from that other stone. And so when you start talking about the lapis, that was the relationship, or that was the reference of that claimed with me. But
you're in the right area, because very often that lapis is purple, and it is an endpoint, and it is I hate to say a perfection, but it's a completion.
The finest lapis actually comes from areas in Russia, and it is flecked with gold.
Yeah. I've got some lapis pieces. I have an egg and a little lapis bottle. Bob likes it too, and we've collected a couple pieces. But it was always, with the idea that, and I can't remember what the properties of the stone are, but I want to say they were of psychic development and kind of a seeking wisdom kind of thing. But specifically, I can't tell you exactly what it said, but it always seemed to me like something very nice to attain.
Yeah, well, you've used the key word there, which is wisdom.
Yeah.
So the lapis is identified with wisdom. But wisdom that's come out of the experience that we're undertaking. So wisdom, when it hits you, when Sophia, let's put this way, when Sophia hits you, very often it hits you in a crisis, or in a in some event in your life that is topsy-turvy, makes your life topsy-turvy, emotionally difficult. And what we're trying to do is help people come out of that experience wiser than they went in. And the lapis is an image of that. And, now to go back to the text, in some accounts, it's said to have light within it. And that light within it is the same light as the moon. It's this diffuse knowing of who you are, where you're to go, what you really feel, what you really believe, what you really want to achieve. And sometimes, strangely, the synchronistic occurrences to make that possible. Because remember, Sophia is that whatever which bridges matter and spirit. So you don't just get the idea, you also get the possibility in time and space.
So in reality, I am the lapis, I am the diamond or the gold, and it's that living from inside out, it's that part where all those precious jewels, you know, they're all inside, so it's what we're doing is bringing that out.
Yeah, but the distinction would be, as far as Jung's concerned, that you aren't the lapis.
Okay, but it's a part of me. I mean,
it's something in you.
Yeah, okay. I was thinking more like the real me, the essence of myself.
Right.
Okay.
With the idea that that's pre-planned.
Yeah.
Plan is always key here.
And I even like the purple because it's like the dawn, because it's the dark, and it's that dark, so as you're discovering the self even more, that's bringing it to the light, the dawn.
Now, do we need to talk at all about Gnosticism, or is that all clear? You see the Gnostic reference here. That this moonlight is also something in the earth. What that means is we're trying to recover something that has been hidden. In Jung's idea, this real self is lost through our first years. Some parents do a better job than others of maintaining it, but it's not an easy task. Depending on
right.
Where you've been raised, yeah, or beaten up. And the events of life often, the events of life that seem like a crisis, often are little pieces of this self coming back to you. That's how Jung works with that Gnostic image. In the Gnostic idea, God gets trapped in matter. And as Jung takes it as a metaphor, the real self gets lost and comes to us experience by experience, which we have to then try to understand to capture that piece of ourselves back out of it.
Are you saying that part of us, that the story is part of God that's in us?
That right. We're working a couple different metaphors now. That Sophia would be the plan which has been lost. And the other implication here is that in daily events, there is a secret intelligence, which is, now here you can be kind of naive about it. I don't want to sound too woo-woo, but at times, what looks like a mess in further inspection has a plan behind it. And the plan behind it is giving you that piece of you that you need now. Well, it certainly may not feel like it at the moment. But we're just looking at this from many different angles. Hopefully I'm not losing you. And I don't expect it to be logically consistent. But can you feel that we're using different metaphors for trying to express the same fact? Gnostic is one image. And the reason it's so relevant to Sophia is that piece of divinity that's been caught in matter.
What's fascinating is that that's chaos theory. And chaos theory says that there's always emergent patterns, but you just can't see them.
You can't see them. Huh?
And so as these things come up, these crises begin to create the patterns for you.
You know, the only thing I might quibble is I don't think they're always. In life, I don't think they're always.
What's always?
Chaos is always producing a pattern. I think sometimes they're just crap, period. And you have to be able to distinguish what's crap and what's meaningful crap. What's meaningless crap and what's meaningful crap, let's put it that way.
Well,
yeah, thanks. Okay, let's see. To 10. Another important passage that we'll certainly spend the rest of the day on. Let me try to understand the implication. Thanks. This is wisdom. Namely, the Queen of the South, who is said to have come from the East, like unto the morning rising. Now, nothing new there, right? To hear, to understand, yea, and to see the wisdom of Solomon. And it was given into her hand power, honor, strength, and dominion, bearing upon her head, now it comes, the crown of the kingdom, shining with the rays of 12 stars, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. That's the key phrase. The crown of the kingdom, shining with the rays of 12 stars, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And having on her garments written in golden letters in Greek, in barbarian script, and in Latin. Reigning, I will reign, and my kingdom shall have no end for all them that find me and subtly and ingeniously and constantly seek me out. Well, the Queen of Sheba references old stuff, right? But let's look at that phrase, the crown of the kingdom shining with the rays of 12 stars. Who hears a familiar biblical reference?
In the Apocalypse?
Revelation?
Yeah, in the apocalypse. Like Revelations 12:1. John sees a woman crowned with stars. And I forget what she's doing. She's standing on a sun, I think, is that right? The moon.
On the moon.
I'm standing on the moon. Standing on the moon. Here it is. With the radiance of the sun. So you've got the stars, sun, and the moon, the sun. The sun is the sun. And she's pregnant. And there's a dragon waiting to devour the child. So the child is born, and she's whisked off to the desert. Now that is a reference, but that is referenced from this passage in the Oracle Surgeons. And it tells us something very important about the nature of this experience he's having when understood from the historical perspective. Anyone remember from the Apocalypse archetype how Edinger works with that image of the woman crowned with the stars?
Are you talking about the fact that the babe is caught up into heaven and that,
right.
That means that this child is going to be something in the future?
Right.
And as opposed to the realization of self now, it's an indication that it will happen in the future.
Right. The idea is that this birth couldn't be Christ, because Christ has already been born. So the way Edinger works with it is it's a image of a development in the collective psyche at that time in history, whereby a new birth is being prepared. But that birth can't occur yet, because if it occurred at that time, it would be devoured. And what would that birth be? The further development, as he takes it, the further development of Christianity, whereby the contents of the psyche that were experienced dogmatically in projection are waiting to be brought home and found within ourselves. But at that time it couldn't occur, because the classical psyche wasn't strong enough to make this happen, to let this happen. So it's our task now, you see. She is coming to us. She doesn't have to be whisked away anymore. It's Sophia to hear. She's adorned, ready to come to us, meaning that this development of the Sophia experience is, first of all, possible now, and secondly, a continuation of the way Christianity was meant to unfold from the very beginning. So you could say that what the book of Revelation does, it forecasts the next development waiting to happen of the Judeo-Christian, I'll call it myth, I don't say that in a pejorative way, story. Not able to happen then. But Thomas's vision, it is now able to happen. Or at least the possibilities there. He, of course, couldn't understand it. We are in a position to understand it. And what it is showing us is the evolution of a religious consciousness. That Sophia is really a historically current task. This is the current religious challenge. Announced to us really through Thomas's vision. not able to be made personal by him. But I think, really, thanks to Jung's work, that we now see there's a way to do it. Another way to say that, to be kind of crude about it, is that we're now in a position of withdrawing our projections from God. That's what she's doing on page 210 and 211. The other reference is prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. It's also from Revelation. Is that ringing a bell for anybody? And she gives us the reference here, footnote 7, Revelation 21. The other main image there in the Revelations in this regard is that Jerusalem, a heavenly Jerusalem, descends.
Where are we?
What I'm doing is going quite a bit into detail on this.
We're talking about Revelation, mm-hmm. with the heavenly Jerusalem.
Yeah, I'm going into that because the phrase, what the vision does, see, it mixes two images. It mixes the woman on the crowned woman and the New Jerusalem. It confabulates them, and it says she is coming like a bride or adorned. But in the book of Revelation, she is present, and then 10 books later, the New Jerusalem is described as coming adorned. You with me? Again, it's fantastic imagery. In the book of Revelation, John sees Jerusalem descending from heaven. And Jerusalem is a bride. It doesn't make sense, but remember, we're doing symbolic thinking here. And the bridegroom is Christ in the book of Revelation. But in the book of Revelation, that marriage occurs in the air. It's a heavenly phenomenon. What does that mean?
Spirit.
Not on the earth. So you've got a development prepared in the spirit, but it can't be realized at that time. But here, she is coming to us adorned. So the psyche is saying a major cultural development can occur, which we see twice in the book of Revelations, could not have occurred then, but can occur now. That's why these visions are so important. They're not only relevant to Thomas personally, they're relevant to us historically. No wonder the poor guy couldn't understand this stuff. You see, the vast expanse of church history which is contained in the implications of some of these images. I want you to have a read them with the psychological lens.
Kind of saying about bridging heaven and earth, though,
saying
that that's what we're kind of
saying. That's another way to say it.
Yeah.
That this Sophia, now we sort of recapitulate, this Sophia experience, pick your metaphor, Gnostic metaphor, piece of God lost in matter, a Jungian metaphor, the self becoming known through physical experiences, the Christian metaphor, the bridging matter and spirit. The possibility of a psychological experience is being announced to this man as he's overcome with this emotional perception of this female. And that female would be, again, pick your metaphor, the ability of human beings to discern how their own lives are to go from within, and noticing how the outer world, not the spiritual world, but the material world, contributes to that unfolding. And that's the religious challenge of our time. Bridging of matter and spirit, finding the divinity in matter, seeing the symbolic importance of physical events. Again, many different ways to describe it. But the key image that holds this all together is Sophia. We're just describing Sophia in many different ways.
This is so exciting.
I do too. And I think it makes all the pains in the butt worth it. Yeah. But see, there really is a point to all of this.
We see on a certain level we're in kind of a regressive time right now because of all the focus on good fighting evil and being able to identify them.
Medieval.
Yeah.
I mean, it's early medieval. Yeah.
That's why the awake must be awake. Certain ages raise the questions that other ages need to answer, and it's our job to get them answered.
I think it
at
is.
This
yeah.
time,
yeah.
And in that process, we're going to be raising the new questions that we simply can't answer.
Yeah.
We can't. We don't have the consciousness for that.
Yeah.
So 500 years from now, somebody's going to be sitting having a conversation about something.
They'll really discover your notes, and they say, "Look what those crazy people were talking about in St. Paul's Episcopal Church. What were they doing?"
And too, I think, like you were saying about the war, the masculine still fighting to that, the idea of the feminine starting to rise. I think we're going to have that duality still trying to still stifle the feminine. You know what I mean? That's part of the I think, the war we're going through just on...
Inner war, so to speak. And I think you've got that dream so clearly, living life from the inside out. Who am I to be? Jung is an incredible optimist in this regard, that if you stop thinking about what you should do, if you stop thinking about what your time needs, if you stop thinking about what the neighbors want you to do, if you just listen to this inner story, it will lead you to the world, and you will give to the world, but from your own story. From what you are, not from what some external definition is asking of you. That's the difference. And his faith is that the human being, when they do that, becomes generous. There is an inherent generosity in us. And the reason we're so stingy is because we're not trying to be somebody we're not. And then the giving has to be a should instead of an is. Well, that takes us to page 212. I think what we'll do next time, by the way, on the study guide, I have page 5 in the study guide. I really should have put another question between 5 and 6. I'm kind of working on this as I go along. So I had in my notes between 5 and 6 commentary. Note the reference to astrology and Christianity, page 212 and following. And I've called that question 6. Am I confusing people?
Mm-hmm.
You can go to page 5. Excuse me, at the top. See question 5, commentary note, apocalypse reference. Then I put in between 5 and 6. What I'm renumbering is number 6. You say commentary, : astrology and Christianity. 212 and following. Then 6 becomes 7, 7 becomes 8, 8 becomes 9.
212 and following?
Yeah, 212 and F. So we'll pick up with that next time. All that does, I'm just going to now, some of you know this, some of you don't. So those who do know, maybe you'll put up with me. But I want to just take what we've said and cast this in the context of Jung's book Ion. How does Jung see the history of Christianity psychologically? Where are we? Nothing new. Just taking what we just said and spend about 5 or 10 minutes on the astrological interpretation of Christianity. How that is what we've been talking about in terms of Sophia's demand for recognition in this historical moment. And we'll go on from there. So basically we've done through question 5 on page 5 in the study guide. So today, how far do we go? Let's try to see. We went to we did about 10 pages. So I think if you read you have time, read the whole. That's a lot. Isn't it? Read through the first paragraph on 231. I don't think we'll get further than that. Do you think? That's 20 pages.
No, we won't get any further.
Yeah, sometimes we get on a roll, we go fast.
Not very often.
Thank you, Mary, for that.
the sick cat has to understand this.
Yeah, thank you.
We're in no hurry.
Okay, thanks. See you in 2. Welcome back.